Let me get a sense, if I may, of how many of you have studied Shakespeare before? How many, may I even ask this, how many of you studied Shakespeare with me before? Okay. And how many of you are brand new at the adult level, that is the you haven't studied Shakespeare in college or more recently than college? How many of you, for you this is a new thing? Okay, great. Shakespeare is an equal opportunity author. It is both easy and hard always to study Shakespeare. It's hard for us and easy for you. That is to say, you keep finding new things. I never get to the bottom of a Shakespeare play or a Shakespeare passage or a phrase in Shakespeare. That's what keeps me going in this. This is my index of what makes great literature. I'm quite nervous about evaluative words like great, but it seems to me that one of the indices of greatness, if we're going to have that, or the high value that we put on literature, is that as you return to it again and again, it continues to give you things that you didn't see before. This is also, I should say, one of the great values of literary criticism and literary analysis, that it continues to open up new paths. And just as you think you have gotten really everything you possibly can out of a passage or a scene or a character or a kind of character, a new approach, and we'll discuss some of those during the course of the semester, may open up things that actually one has not seen because one's been looking through a lens of this kind, and we want to look through a lens of this kind. Think of it as a set of filters that you might be putting in front of your eyes to show you the image through green or through red or through indeed rose color. So we'll talk about Shakespeare's plays, and we'll talk about approaches to the plays. And when I say we, this is not the royal we. This is the actual we of those of us who are in this room. I have been teaching Shakespeare at Harvard for more years than I like to admit. I, for many years, taught a lecture course in Sanders Theatre, which was a two-semester Shakespeare course. Sometimes people took the whole year of it, and sometimes they took one semester of it. And I wondered years ago how I was ever going to bring myself to stop teaching that course, which was a very wonderful course for me to teach, very exhilarating, and kept showing me new things about Shakespeare and about the plays. And then a publisher came to me and said, how about writing a book about Shakespeare that does that thing that many people had been telling the publisher was wanted, that is to say, provides a chapter on every play. And I did that, and that's what this book, Shakespeare After All, is. And once I published the book, I felt I could no longer teach that course because what I would have said ex cathedra was now in the book. So this course is deliberately called Shakespeare After All. It could be called Shakespeare After Shakespeare After All, I think, because it builds what I have to say in writing into the experience that I hope and that we ask that you bring to these sessions every week. So that each week we ask you to read a play of Shakespeare and also my chapter on that play. And I may, in my remarks, go over some of the things that I've said here. I may not. You should also understand that this, like any piece of literary criticism or literary theory, is interpretation. It is my view of things. It is, I hope, supported by evidence that I bring to bear on the arguments that I put forward, but it is not the only truth, and you may think that in some places I'm actually quite far from the truth, or that I'm actually making an argument that with which you want to take issue, or where you need me to explain further in order for me to persuade you of something, so that we will hope that in the discussion part of our time together, you'll feel free to pose questions both about the plays and also about my interpretation of the plays, or indeed about any other interpretation that you may have read or experienced, or any production that you have seen. Because certainly every production is an interpretation. Every actor, every director, every audience finds something new in these plays. They're at the very this very moment, I think, at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. Ian McKellen is doing his King Lear, which got a lot of very interesting reviews. You may have seen them in the New York Times and other major publications. This is a major Shakespearean actor. He was here many years ago on an American tour, and he and I actually did a radio program together on Macbeth. He was then appearing in Macbeth, and we did a radio program together at WBUR discussing what it was like for him to perform Macbeth. I wish I could do that with him about his King Lear. But this is he certainly has been praised very much for bringing his experience as a lifelong actor as well as a lifelong person into this production of King Lear, which is otherwise, so far as I can tell, I have not been able to get a ticket to it, a relatively traditional production of the play. That is to say, it is set on a heath, he is wearing rags, it is not transformed into some other time period or some other place. Though I gather the fool in that play, in this this version of the play, is a theatrical entertainer of some kind, and is thought of as somebody who actually stages plays of his own. Closer to home, a production that you will certainly be able to see, and that I might well invite you to see, is a production by the Actors Shakespeare Project, which is a Shakespeare theater in town here, which did last year a very brilliant Titus Andronicus, and is doing Macbeth in October. And they've asked me actually to moderate the discussion about the production. And in this case, it's a relatively untraditional production. Again, I've not seen any rehearsals of it yet, but every character in the play is played by a woman. So this is an all-female Macbeth. And it will interrogate issues of women and power and issues of gender as performance and a whole range of other things. The Titus Andronicus was done in what would have been Shakespeare's own, the kind of production of Shakespeare's own time, that is to say all the parts were played by men. You may know that in Shakespeare's time, in England, no women appeared upon the public stage, so that every female character in Shakespeare, including those that we have come to rely upon as icons of womanhood or femininity, whether it's Juliet or Lady Macbeth or Cleopatra or Cressida or Portia, that all of these characters are cast for and played by men in Shakespeare's day, which is to say that gender is from the beginning within Shakespeare an invented and performed thing, not a natural or merely imitative thing. And what's fascinating about this to me is that so many of our own stereotypes about what women are like, a Juliet, a Lady Macbeth, a Cleopatra, come from these characters who were initially performed by, played by, and designed for male actors. But the Actors Shakespeare Project is turning the tables on this question and producing an entirely female Macbeth. And the discussion, which will be happening on, I think the production begins on October 18th, and the discussion, which I'm asked to moderate, is on a Tuesday night, October 30th, and there will be people who are directors and people who are scholars of psychology, and once I get the list of who they are, I'll be happy to share this with you. But we absolutely encourage you to see as much Shakespeare as you can. How many of you have actually acted in productions of Shakespeare? Recently? Fairly recently? Good. Directed productions of Shakespeare? All right. Used Shakespeare in classroom or other teaching situations? Like what? In what kind of situation? High school teaching, okay, right. Because Shakespeare, the reason I ask is that Shakespeare these days is being used in business schools a great deal as kind of case studies for problem solving of one kind or another. That the plays are so available as kind of the myths of our time, stories that people are thought to be quite familiar with, that they're often being used to exemplify hard choices or leadership issues or racial discrimination or some other current day issue, which is localized in a fictional situation, in this case not a, you know, Jane went to the market and encountered Farmer X, but a story that would have to do with Portia going to the courtroom and encountering Shylock and Antonio. And so Shakespeare has moved into modern culture and into popular culture in this way. So we would encourage you to experience your Shakespeare, our Shakespeare. The Germans used to say unser Shakespeare. Shakespeare as an initially German writer. You should make Shakespeare your own. And in fact, the very beginning of this book of mine, this Shakespeare After All, begins by claiming that we all create, every age creates its own Shakespeare. That Shakespeare is like a mirror or like a portrait whose eyes follow you around the room. That people recognize themselves in Shakespearean characters and situations and phrases, that we think through Shakespeare, that we use the phrases that we encounter in these plays to express the situations of common life, and that Shakespeare is already inside us, whether you have ever studied Shakespeare formally or informally before. You will come upon things. There's a famous story about probably apocryphal story about a woman who went to the theater and saw a production of Hamlet and walked out at the interval and said that it was all made of quotations. And that's because supposedly she had encountered it as sets of quotes beforehand. But I think that you'll find, even in the plays with which you may be less familiar, that that's where that comes from. I'm trying to think of a line from Troilus and Cressida that would function in this way, and I had one on the tip of my tongue. I'll think of one, but anyway, you'll find that there are lines that function precisely in this way. So this course is a completely self-contained one. You need not have read the earlier plays of Shakespeare in order to read these. I teach the plays as early and late by preference rather than by genre, rather than by teaching a course on the comedies and the histories or the tragedies or the romances, because it's so interesting to me to see what the playwright and his company seem to have been doing and engaging at a given moment in time that echoes from play to play at a given time period. Seemed to me absolutely as interesting as anything that we could say was determined by genre. And I'll say some things in just a second about these Shakespearean genres and the degree to which they do or don't actually function. But first, if you'll just have a look with me at the syllabus, I just want to indicate to you something about what it is that we are doing, and then I'll say something about what this actually contains. So today we're going to talk in general about Shakespeare, about his times, about the start point, really, of these so-called later plays, in the second half of this time period, we'll look closely at a couple of passages in order to come to grips with Shakespearean language and see how rich it is. And then we plunge into Troilus and Cressida and Measure for Measure. Again, let me take a kind of census here. How many of you have read or seen Troilus and Cressida recently, in the last 5 years? Great. Okay. Measure for Measure. Fantastic. Okay. Othello. Because by the time we get to Othello, we're getting to the plays that for a long time in the last century, the 20th century, were thought of as, you know, the great tragedies of Shakespeare. Othello, King Lear, Hamlet, Macbeth. Hamlet is written in 1599, 1600, and does not fall into the later plays category. We'll be talking about Hamlet from time to time. But these other plays, the great tragedies, so-called, became the centerpiece of the study of Shakespeare, really partly as a result of the famous Oxford lectures of the critic A.C. Bradley, who thought of these as Shakespeare's mature tragedies, and the Bradley plays, so-called, became, for the 20th century, the kind of measures of Shakespearean greatness. And I just want to say, as a kind of parenthesis around this, that there have been times in the history, in the long history of Shakespearean reception, when the comedies were thought of as more important than the tragedies, when the romances, which are the latest plays that we'll come to in a moment and that will come at the end of our semester, were thought of as the culmination of his work, that the different kinds of plays that Shakespeare writes have been valued by different time periods and different places at different levels. So that we should not automatically assume, because we are ourselves the heirs of the 20th century, that these great central tragedies are the best, the strongest, the mature, the culmination of his work. On the other hand, they are fabulous plays, and they are certainly the work of a playwright working and a theatrical manager working at the height of his powers. But I will want to try to demonstrate to you week after week how remarkable each of these plays is on its own and in conversation with the others and with the times. So we're going to start with these plays that mark really the turning point from the late 16th century to the early 17th century, moving into, in historical terms, the time when King James actually came to the throne, replacing Queen Elizabeth in England. Now, again, one can make too much of the break between the Elizabethan plays and the Jacobean plays, but once upon a time, again, a course like this would have been called Elizabethan and Jacobean Shakespeare, or the plays by authors who were not Shakespeare writing in the same period would have been called Elizabethan and Jacobean drama. And this acknowledges the degree to which Shakespeare and his company wrote and performed in a patronage culture, in a culture in which the monarch and or a set of leading nobles were very determinative in what was approved, in what was performed, what was disapproved. This is a moment when the Renaissance theater is coming into being. Prior to the time of Shakespeare and his contemporaries, whether it's Christopher Marlowe in the 1600s or Ben Jonson in the early 1700s, whether it's Marston or Middleton or Heywood, but prior to this time, the theater is very much more related to either the church or to morality. In the north of England in particular, there are what are called miracle plays and morality plays being performed, which are either depict scenes from the Bible and with a kind of teleological function, that is to say, starting at the beginning of Genesis and moving through toward Revelation. With the idea, now again, remember that we're dealing in a culture in which not everybody can read. This is not necessarily a literate culture, so you see perform scenes from the Bible, and this is one way that you understand how this founding text functions. And these performances, indeed, were personalized by the development, among other things, of certain kinds of theatrical types, so that Mrs. Noah became a kind of type of the nagging housewife, and a type that's still recognizable in situation comedies today, and that has its more sophisticated, mature versions in a play, let us say, like the Comedy of Errors of Shakespeare, in which there's a husband and a wife, in which the wife keeps saying, "Why aren't you home for dinner?" And it's much a leftover of this idea of the sort of the man being controlled by the wife. And this thematic will show up, let us say, even in Macbeth in a slightly different way. So these types developed. King Herod, the king of the Jews, who orders the slaughter of the firstborn, is thought of as a kind of ranting tyrant. When Hamlet, in his play, cautions the players not to out-Herod Herod, not to overact, to throw their hands around, to gesture too much, and so forth, he is making reference to this figure of Herod from the old miracle plays, which, again, were still in the memory of some of the populace. These plays continue to be performed together with morality plays, that is, plays like Everyman, plays that where characters have symbolic names, like Good Deeds or Everyman or the Four Wits or the Seven Deadly Sins. And characters like that, too, are carried over into the Shakespearean drama. In, for example, the very famous figure called the Vice, V-I-C-E, the embodiment of a certain resistance to happiness, resistance to personal success, a trickster figure, and a figure indeed of viciousness. And the vice figure is mentioned explicitly in a play like Richard III. It's mentioned by Falstaff in Henry IV, Part I. These are both early plays. And we'll see that in a play like Othello, there are in Iago some vestiges of this stock character of the vice, who is both comic and antisocial, often witty at the expense of others, often confiding to the audience in a set of asides, and that not only Iago, but the figure of Edmund in King Lear will carry some of those aspects too. So there's a kind of residual cultural memory here. It's not necessarily the case that anyone in the Shakespearean audience has ever seen any of these miracle or morality plays, but they are the literary heritage, or one of the many literary heritages that are being carried through. And we'll see that there are other heritages. For example, when we come to Troilus and Cressida, you'll see that the recovery of the ancient Greek and Roman texts makes a tremendous difference to how it is that Elizabethan and Jacobean people and writers imagined themselves, that they saw themselves as successor cultures. We talk about the American century. This was, in a way, the Renaissance English century that thought it was recovering and recapturing the glories of ancient Greece and Rome. And so they measured themselves, to a certain extent, against these older cultures. In the late 1500s, Sir Thomas North translates Plutarch's parallel lives of the ancient Greeks and Romans. And Plutarch's Lives was a book that compared an ancient Greek hero with an ancient Roman hero. These Plutarch's Lives in the North translation are one of the many sources for Shakespeare's plays, and especially for his plays that speak about ancient Greece or ancient Rome. But we have to also imagine the writers and the audiences of Shakespeare's day as putting a third comparison figure next to the Greek and the Roman, and that was the figure of their own time, the figure of the Renaissance. How is a Renaissance king or queen or monarch or duke comparable to Brutus or to Mark Antony or to Timon of Athens? And so this comparative mode, this mode that is both referential and comparative, is one of the things that makes it useful to know something about the intellectual background and the theatrical background of these plays. At the same time, there's a radical difference between those plays and Shakespeare's plays in that the Shakespearean theater, or I should say the early modern theater, the theater of the Renaissance, is a commercial theater being performed in a non-sacred place, in a purpose-built place, in theaters built to be theaters. The first one that Shakespeare's company played in was called The Theater, and it was built in 1576, and its timbers were torn down at the end of the 16th century to build the theater that you probably most associate with Shakespeare. What's the name of that theater? The Globe Theater. And it is built out of, in part, the dissembled pieces of this earlier theater. Have any of you been to the Globe, the reconstructed Globe in England, and on the bank side of the Thames? Very faithful reconstruction, with the company getting increasingly good. I've seen some good things and some not so such good things there. But if you've been there, you will know that the acting is played in the outdoors. There's no roof. Therefore, there's no electricity in 16th and 17th century England either. So the plays are performed in the afternoon, and it's a very democratic kind of theater space, in that the below the stage is on a little platform, below the stage is an area in which people stand and do not sit, and they're called the groundlings. They could bring their own stools, but there's no place provided for them to sit. And then there are tiers of seats around the sides in which, for a little bit more money, if you were a person with more to spend, you could have a seat. You could even, if you were a person with a good deal of money, sit in a curtained off space and have a sexual dalliance while you were watching the plays. I want you to think about this as being as much like a modern sporting event as like a sacred theatrical event, because food is being sold, dalliances of various kinds of canoodling is going on behind these curtains. People shout out and speak back to the actors. It's a space in which the theater is truly interactive, and it has, there's no front curtain, so that there is an intimacy, a potential intimacy between the actor and the audience, even though the Globe Theater, we think, could have held about 2,000 people. So we're not talking about a space like this. We're talking about a space in which there could be lots and lots and lots of people, people of different social stations, women as well as men, apprentices as well as kings and queens and noblemen, all sitting in this space that became a democratic space. Wrong place. Take care. When an actor comes out to speak in soliloquy, or you may think of it as monologue, soliloquy, the single voice speaking, he or she is speaking intimately to the audience in the theater. And whether what's happening in that soliloquy is confiding one's inner thoughts or confiding a plot or a plan, that is to say, whether it's Hamlet telling you that to be or not to be, that is the question, where you think, oh, to be or not, that is the question, you know, the universal question, or whether it's Iago, as you'll see, coming out and saying, I have it, it is engendered, hell and night will bring this monstrous plot to the world's light, making you his confidant, making you guilty in the theater, because you know what's going to go on that Othello doesn't know, and you are therefore ganging up on him together with Iago because you already know the plan, and you, because of the convention of the theater, cannot warn Othello what's going on. This device of the soliloquy was a way of creating, among other things, a kind of psychological inside for a character. Shows you how the inner workings of somebody's mind would function, shows you their inner thoughts. A figure like Iago or a figure like Richard III or any other, quotes, villain has got to have two faces, has got to be able to make nice on stage while making very much not nice in his own mind or her own mind and sharing that not niceness with you. So it creates an inside and an outside of a character. And we'll see when we come to look at some passages that it's not only the soliloquy but the language itself that creates thickness, dimension, a roundness of these characters, that these are not merely allegorical characters, though they partake of allegory. They are not merely symbolic characters, though they have become for us deeply symbolic of ambition, of self-doubt, of true love, of a whole variety of things, because they're Shakespeare. But these are characters who have what we think of as personality. And personality here is, if I can use a technical term here from literary study, a back formation. That is, you develop a sense that somebody has a personality from the contradictions that you sense within their persona, from the resistances that they, should I do this or should I do that? If they have no self-doubt, if they have no internal dialogue, then it's much harder to see that they are not merely cardboard cutouts. But almost every Shakespearean character, from the lowest to the highest, has this kind of dimension, has a hidden story as well as a present story. And this will all be disclosed in language, whether it's the language of the individual or the language of dialogue. Because, of course, we're dealing here with theater, not with lyric poetry, and not with novels. So that every character could represent something that Shakespeare, whoever that was, thought or didn't think. Every utterance made by a character in these plays has its own validity. There is no space, and you'll see this very explicitly when we come to Troilus and Cressida, which is a play very much built on dialogues between people. Somebody says, let's go left, and the other one says, let's go right, and so forth. And there's no way that you can say, Shakespeare's on the side of those who are saying, let's go right, and he's against those who are saying, let's go left. These dialogues are meant to make you understand that there are many sides to these questions, and whether the sides are moral or ethical or aesthetic or romantic or erotic or political, the dialogue is really what you get. We're never going to get to a point where we say, aha, Shakespeare believes this. We cannot know what Shakespeare believes. And so one of the things that I want you to sort of put a big mental X through as we come to look at these plays and even as we come to talk today is the question of trying to read Shakespeare's mind. What did Shakespeare think? What did he have in mind when he did this? I can tell you, and Mel and Larry can tell you, and we can all guess and hypothesize about what would have been likely in the period. It would have been unlikely that he ever seen a bicycle or been in an airplane. I mean, there's some things that we can say he probably wasn't thinking about because they would be anachronistic, which doesn't mean that they wouldn't be, we couldn't, you know, today have, as Peter Sellers famously did, a King Lear at Adam's house, which was a Cadillac on the stage. I think we can probably say fairly confidently that he wasn't thinking about, that Shakespeare didn't have General Motors in mind, but that something anachronistic can function extremely well within a Shakespearean play. In fact, the plays themselves are deeply anachronistic. There's a striking clock in Julius Caesar at a time when there were not striking clocks in ancient Rome and so forth. And what, in fact, this business of anachronism does is to show you something about the modernity of Shakespeare again, that Shakespeare is always in the present time as well as in an earlier time. So no matter what the time period or the nation in which a play is set, if it's ancient Greece, ancient Rome, medieval England, medieval Scotland, it's set in that time period. It is written and initially performed in Shakespeare's own time, the late 16th or the early 17th century, and it is being read by us and or performed or seen by us in the present day. And don't ever erase the present day. You cannot make yourself into an Elizabethan or Jacobean person. You cannot put yourself into a purifying time machine and go back and get rid of all your modernity. You can learn a lot about earlier periods, but you're still going to be thinking about them from your perspective as a person of today. And this is a plus rather than a minus. The authentic Shakespeare is a moving target. The authentic Shakespeare is not only the Shakespeare of the early modern period, but also the Shakespeare that you experience. So on the one hand, we want to be cautious about certain kinds of anachronisms. On the other hand, we want to allow interpretively the function of anachronism creatively here. But we're not going to be able to read Shakespeare's mind. We're not going to be able to... It's not profitable for us to try to speculate too much about whether he liked blondes or brunettes, for example. Did the dark lady of the sonnets represent his own personal taste, or did he prefer, you know, fair ladies or fair gentlemen? These are interesting questions. These are questions that belong to the world of speculation and biography. But in fact, Shakespeare's plays are full of both blondes and brunettes, and their chief function is to be notional opposites or alternatives to one another. It's not about blondness and it's not about brunetteness. In the plays, at least, it's about an interplay between tall and short or blonde and brunette or old and young or Greek or Trojan. It's about interplays and about dialogues and conversations. So the Shakespearean drama, as we will be entering into it, is a Shakespearean drama that has been evolved on the public stage in England for decades already, that this is a moment of high theatrical ferment. Think about, as an analogy, about the early days of Hollywood, for example, the early days of filmmaking, when it was really exciting to be creating a new medium and seeing what it could do, and changing what the medium could do, adding sound to film, adding plot to film, adding fiction to film, adding color to film. So also, for these early modern writers, they had a medium, the theater, that they were able to make do lots of different things. And part of it is the discovery of how to use language, character, costume, the physical stage, as a way of stretching the medium, making the medium, the theater, do something new. And so there will always be something self-referential about these plays, something meta-theatrical, as we say, theater about theater, some little moment in which people say, oh, this is just like being in a play, or as an actor said, walking on the stage, or Macbeth says, you know, that like a poor player who struts and frets his hour upon the stage, that there'll always be some gesture, some acknowledgement that this is a medium, that it's talking about its own possibilities, whether it's talking about language or about character or about costume or about disguise or about impersonation. There's always going to be this meta-theatrical, referential element within the plays. This is not the reductio of the plays. This is not the only thing that they are about, but they are about the medium just as they are about the narrative and the characters and the language. And so by the time, Shakespeare, I should say, is part of an acting and theater company. He is, we know, an actor as well as a theatrical manager. He belonged to a company that actually made more money than any other theater company. But there are a lot of startups, a lot of companies that are starting up in this period. And they're all called things like the Lord Admiral's Men or the Lord Chamberlain's Men or Lord Strange's Men. They're all called somebody or other's men because of a statute promulgated under the time of Queen Elizabeth against what are called masterless men in this culture. That is, marauding bands of people who were homeless and hungry and wandering about England and of whom the state was frightened. So the idea that you didn't want mobs, as to use an anachronistic word, but that you didn't want masterless men wandering about England got in the way of the way theater was practiced in this period, which is to say that these were traveling players very often. They moved, especially in the summer months, from great house to great house. They performed not only in the state theaters, but also in private homes. And especially when there was plague in England, which there was frequently, especially in the warmer months, if there was plague for too many days, the theaters were shut down by the state. And in order for the players to make any money, they had indeed to go traveling. So traveling groups of male actors were masterless men unless they were, in fact, had a master. And so if you had a patron of your company, Lord Strange as your patron, or the Lord Admiral as your patron, you were not masterless. You belonged to an acting company, and you could be legitimate. And that's why these so and so's men functions here as a kind of cover to allow these acting companies to function. This is kind of early capitalism. This is the beginning of you have a product or a service to sell, and Shakespeare's company, which began as the Lord Chamberlain's company. And then when King James came to the throne, was adopted by the king, who made himself their patron and became the king's men in 1603. This was the most successful company of many successful companies in Shakespeare, in early modern England. And the plays that they wrote and the plays that they performed were not, it's not like Cats. It's not like something runs for 400 performances. 10 is a good number of performances in this period. So they're rehearsing, they're learning a new play in the morning, they're performing in the afternoon, they may be writing a play at night when they're not drinking. And the plays are performed in repertory. The plays are performed not a solid run of one thing, because again, you've got an audience that's before television, before radio. There are very few books around, actually. This is a major entertainment. This is a kind of entertainment that along the banks of the Thames functions side by side with bear baiting and it's Michael Vick. You know, it's all kinds of animal things. There are dogs. There's cockfighting. There's all kinds of displays. It's a much more robust era than our own. Public hangings were among the most popular events to be attended by audiences. So that this is a kind of entertainment which has a major social function and a major kind of collective social function. And just to give you an idea, an apprentice's daily wage would be about the same amount of money as a ticket to the theater. So they are writing and performing and inventing and being rivalrous to one another. And the theater flourishes under Queen Elizabeth, who is very interested in it. And so the early plays very often have some glancing reference to her. It's full of empowered young women who become strong. And then King James comes to the throne in 1603. And it's about this time, it's actually a little earlier than that that we're going to start, but it's about this time that our plays begin. And James is very different from Elizabeth. James is the son of Mary, Queen of Scots, who was Elizabeth's great rival and whom Elizabeth had beheaded. James was King of Scotland, James the sixth of Scotland, and he was, since Elizabeth is the virgin queen, she does not have a husband, she does not have any heirs of her own body, and she kept control of the state for a long time, partially because she did not have to share her power with a man, and she did not have children who would succeed her. And so James is her heir, and he inherits the throne from her in 1603. And the plays that we're going to be looking at are all plays, or mostly plays, that are produced under the time of James. Again, one can overstress this. When we come to Macbeth, we'll talk about James's interest in witches and witchcraft and the degree to which writing a play that was about witchcraft was certainly a gesture that would have been of great interest to the king. And I can talk to you when we come to Measure for Measure, even, about things that people have said about the Duke in Measure for Measure, the Duke of Dark Corners, as he's called, and how he seemed to some of them, to some critics, I should say, to resemble King James in his penchant for spying from afar, having intelligence brought to him of what was going on. James was a very peculiar guy in lots of ways. He was a scholar. He was also very interested in the court mask, in a certain kind of court performance. He had very strong feelings about certain political matters. And certain historical matters, and we'll talk all about these as we go through. But the plays that we're looking at are the plays that are, roughly speaking, the second half of Shakespeare's career, starting about 1603, and moving through to The Tempest, which is, we think, a play written in 1611, and performed in 1611, which is often misguidedly described as Shakespeare's farewell to the stage. In fact, he didn't say goodbye to the stage in 1611. He wrote at least one other play completely on his own, which we're not going to have time to look at, Henry VIII or All Is True. How many are familiar with Henry VIII or All Is True? Okay, great. He collaborated with other people on other plays at this point. Shakespeare's born in 1564. He dies in 1616. And the first folio of his plays is published in 1623, which is to say, he did not design it. It is published as a homage to him by two members of his acting company, Hemmings and Condell. And they publish it in folio form, which is a great big, I wish I'd brought one in, a great big form, which is normally used in this period for sermons and for learned information of various kinds, not for plays, which were thought of as trash, thought of as paperback books of their time. As Sir Thomas Bodley, when he built his library at Oxford, forbade play scripts to be put into the Bodleian Library because he said, baggage books. They were trash. They were low. They were too funny and too dirty and not edifying and so forth. Shakespeare's plays aren't the first plays to be published in folio form. Ben Jonson published his own plays in folio form in 1612, and he was a great classical scholar, had the word opera, meaning works, lettered on the spine of the folio, and he took a lot of heat for publishing plays in the folio form. It's as if you were to do, you know, an opera out of South Park or something like that, that you would be bringing together two things that would sometimes be thought of as not cohering. But the first folio is, so to speak, the first authorized collective publication of Shakespeare's plays. Before that, the plays are published in quarto form, and a quarto is about this size. It's a piece of paper folded to be about this size. And so they are like little paperbacks, and some of them are authorized, and some of them are not authorized, and some of them have the playwright's name on the title page, and some don't, because the playwright isn't really the most important person at this point. The person who made money out of the quartos was the bookseller, not the playwright, not the company, but the guy who actually produced the physical object. The playwright is, I mean, the copyright appears in English law in the beginning of the 18th century, 1710, the Statute of Anne. Before that time, authors don't really own their works in the way that we think of authors as having copyright rights. So there's a lot of borrowing back and forth, a lot of creative borrowing. But the first folio of Shakespeare's plays is what divides the plays into these hypothetical sub-areas of comedies, histories, and tragedies. Sometimes plays are sort of on the cusp between one status and another. Troilus and Cressida is one such play. Is it a comedy? Is it a history? It's not quite clear on the title page of one version. It claims to be one thing. On the title page of another version, it claims to be something else. These categories are categories that are invented and made to be played with, in other words. There's no genre police out there saying, here are the rules of a comedy, and if you disobey these rules, then you know you fail as a comedy. In fact, what we'll see as we come to look at these plays is that all comedies have bits of history in them and bits of tragedy in them, that all tragedies have bits of comedy and bits of history and so forth, and often very, very, very self-consciously so, and that they kind of push against these genres so that, I mean, what would be some things that you would hypothetically say would be true of a comedy? Yes? Happy ending. What would that mean?
That would mean the community comes together
at a comedy. Okay, good. And yet, I will be happy to prove to you that every single Shakespearean comedy does not do that. That there's somebody left out, some marriage that doesn't take place, some foreboding remark about, you know, what might happen in the future. There's some thread, some loose endings, which makes them such good plays, where it doesn't, all the pieces don't come together so perfectly. They move in that direction, and yet there's something left over. There's something left to go. And the tragedies we'll see very often end with somebody, often a person of high rank, coming forward and saying, now we've all come together, we lived through all this, you know, all this together, and now we've learned our lesson and so forth. And inevitably you can hear the Jaws music behind, that there's foreboding in the very attempt to bring everything together. It doesn't mean that it's actually dark rather than light. I mean, that would be too simple to say as well. But just that it's always nuanced at the end, that as it's nuanced in the middle, that these things are not perfectly happy or perfectly tragic, that in fact the playwright is playing extremely knowledgeably with these impulses. There's a temptation in talking about these genres also to try to align them with ancient Greek structures. A Shakespearean tragedy is not very much like a Greek tragedy. It has certain broad structural things that we could say that it has in common. It has recognition. It has discovery moments. But in fact, they had a notion of how it was that classical tragedy was written. There was this idea that somehow a good play had unities attached to it. If you go back and you look at Aristotle's art of poetry, poetics, you'll see that he talks really about one play should have unity of action. That is to say, it shouldn't be disparate. Shakespeare's plays violate this notion of the unity of action all the time by having, for example, double plots. Anybody who knows King Lear knows that there's the Gloucester plot and the King Lear plot, and that the two plots will come together. That's what makes for an interesting Shakespearean structure, but it's not quite the same as unity of action. Unity of the Elizabethan Jacobean period thought that also there should be unity of time and unity of place, and you'll see that these plays violate those supposed precepts all the time. That in the late plays that we're going to look at, like The Tempest or Cymbeline or Pericles, there are great blocks of time. In the middle of Winter's Tale, there's a block of 14 years between Act 3 and Act 4. This is not unity of time. In Pericles, the action is set, as the stage direction says, dispersedly in many Mediterranean countries. So this is not unity of place. These plays, again, have somewhere in the back of their minds this idea about unities, but they have them there in order to sort of push against them. And in fact, the idea of these three unities was slightly a Renaissance misreading of Aristotle, the idea that time, place, and action were the three unities. Action is really what Aristotle seems to speak about. And action here for us would have to do, again, with whether there was something satisfactory or fitting for us in the ending of the play. So I meant to direct your attention to the syllabus, and I'm going to now go back just through it, just to say out loud that we're going to do Troilus and Cressida, and then Measure for Measure. Both plays that have sometimes been described, there was a time in the early and the middle part of the last century, the 20th century, when these were described as problem plays or dark comedies. The phrase problem plays, and we'll talk about this more when we get to these plays, was really borrowed from the middle plays of Ibsen or of Shaw, plays that seemed to be about social problems, problems of the culture, whether it's water pollution or syphilis or women's rights or something like that. This is where this phrase problem play comes from. And these plays really are about, Measure for Measure you'll see is a city comedy. It's about a corrupt society and how you can fix that. They're whores and pimps. It's not kings and queens. And so these plays were sort of diagnosed as problem plays, borrowing this epithet from the early 20th century dramatists. They are problem plays after a fashion, but this is a kind of made-up title, and it's not one that's used very much anymore. But they are deeply and interestingly problematic, and they're plays very much about sort of emergent characters and character types. Othello, King Lear, Macbeth, I don't really need to say anything about why they're here. Antony and Cleopatra is, in my view, one of the most magnificent plays in the entire Shakespearean canon. I never like to play favorites here, but I love this play. And it's great fun and exciting and exhilarating to talk about. It is a, quote, Roman play as well as a tragedy because it's set in Rome and in Egypt. And Coriolanus is also a Roman play, but where Antony comes at sort of the end of the empire, Coriolanus comes at the very beginning of Republican Rome or nascent Rome. It's a very different moment, and it's a long time period in Rome, so we don't think of these as exactly the same time period, even though they're both, quotes, Roman. And then we come to this cluster of four plays, Pericles, Cymbeline, The Winter's Tale, and The Tempest, that have been variously called romances or late plays or tragic comedies or a variety of other things. All of these, again, labels that people have used to try to control them a little bit, to give them a generic expectation that would allow for you to know how to read them or how to perform them. When we come to talk about them, I'll say some more about the genre of romance, the adventure, the fantasy tale, and so on. But we'll encounter an encapsulated romance much earlier when we get to Othello, when we find that Othello has told the stories of his adventures as a hero in uncharted territories, fighting against monsters and tribes and sea figures and so forth, in such a way that he has enchanted Desdemona and made her stop what she was doing and stand dumbfounded and listen to him. And the stories that Othello tells, even though they're his actual stories, are really romance stories, stories from a kind of romance genre. The romance is a term that really begins at the end of the 19th century. These plays become called romances, and it's meant to kind of praise their fairy tale aspect. This is the great Victorian period in which fairy literature is interesting to people, in which empire is also interesting to people, and this idea of adventuring beyond the local. Late plays was meant to be, on the one hand, a very neutral kind of designation that would not give anything away. These are late in Shakespeare's career. But I think that we need also to think about them in the way in which people talk about late style these days, to say the late music of Beethoven, or the kind of work that is done, or the late work of Rembrandt, kind of work that is done by an accomplished artistic master toward the end of a career, when what you can see very often, and we'll see this with these plays, is a mere pinstroke, a mere gesture. You wouldn't have to paint the whole canvas thickly. You could have a sketch would show you the whole figure behind it because the gesture is itself so accomplished. We'll see that with Shakespeare, that there are these characters are often sketched rather than fully formed because they're referenced to characters we met earlier in Shakespeare's plays. The last of these designations, tragicomedy, was actually what these plays were often called in the period, a mixture of tragedy and comedy. And this was thought of by some people as mingling kings and clowns, to use Philip Sidney's terms, as a kind of mixture that you shouldn't do, but it's actually a highly desirable, highly audience-pleasing genre at the time that Shakespeare is writing them. So these plays all a little bit match up to what it was that interested audiences. We will now come and take a little break. We're going to always take a break in the middle, and this is partly, again, to think about the medium, partly a break that is enforced for us by the fact that we have tapes rolling and we come to the end of the tape, but this is also time for you to take a little breath of air, walk around if you like, use the restroom, come back in about 5 minutes, and we'll begin again. Just one or two. I was asked a question, a question I should have answered before it was asked, about what Shakespeare text you should use, and my answer really is any good text with notes attached to it. We've ordered the Norton Shakespeare for you. I'm a great fan of the Riverside Shakespeare. The Bantam Shakespeares are fine. The Signet individual volumes are fine. The Penguin volumes are fine. Please use, however, an edition that does have textual notes and glossed notes that explain what words mean and so forth. Don't use the old Yale Shakespeare or something that's got no notes. You are going to need the notes. You're going to need to have that information. Yes? Pelican's fine. Pelican's absolutely fine. Some of you may prefer to have individual volumes rather than carry a big, heavy single volume. I don't care what edition you use. My Shakespeare, after all, is keyed to, that is to say, that when I give act, scene, and line numbers, they refer specifically to the Norton, but that was just because I had to refer to something. And the reason that line numbers will vary from edition to edition is because Shakespeare writes in prose as well as in verse, and a line of prose depends upon how wide the page is. So you will find that there's a slight variation if you're using the Riverside or the Pelican, and I say Act 3, Scene 2, Line 42, it could be Line 46 in your edition, but you will find it easily, and that's not sufficient reason to buy the Norton rather than some other edition.
I do, however, insist that you buy this. But which what Shakespeare edition you use really is, it doesn't matter to us. One of the editions that has the most notes is the Arden, which I do recommend if you want to invest in some interesting, you know, something that's edited very, very fully. But whatever you have is fine with us. I'm now rather inelegantly going to take off these various microphones and give them to Mel so that she can explain the web component of the course, which is one of its most exciting aspects. And as Mel suggested, very often we hear people, because people become so involved with Shakespeare, and it does feel so familiar and so appealing, that people will say, well, you know what, I get the feeling that, or I was just wondering whether. And utterances like that, which are absolutely human and instinctive, fall into the same category as, why did Shakespeare do X? There's no proof that can be evidenced from that. So I get the feeling that is going to be answered by us by saying, well, what in the text do you think has given you that feeling? And we're going to want you to go back to the language or the gestures of the plays in order to say, well, I see that I get the feeling that Hamlet is a stunted adolescent because he is spending so much time worrying about his mother rather than about anything else. That's not a particularly good example because it's so general an example. The other thing I should say is that it's not so much about what not to do as the pleasures of what you can do with Shakespeare, and the enormous pleasures of what you can do with Shakespeare are to encounter the plays as intimately and specifically as possible. So we thought we might start with some passages for the time that we have left and read through them and try to encourage a general discussion. Larry does have the microphone, and so I guess... So, Larry, you got a microphone, right? So can you be my other on the dialogues and be understood? Okay. You want to be Cleopatra or you want to be Dolabella?
I think I'll be Dolabella.
His face, I should say that the topic here is, just to give you, set the scene for you a little bit. One of the fascinating things about Antony and Cleopatra, as you'll see, is that these are two very titanic figures. Which is going to subsume the other. He is the embodiment of a certain Romanness, she the quintessence of Egypt in all its variations. And the structural answer to who wins is that Antony dies in Act 4 and Cleopatra lives through Act 5. So here we have Act 5, Scene 2, and Cleopatra is conversing with one of Antony's soldiers, Dolabella, about her imagination of Antony. And you'll see when we come to the play that everybody has a fantasy about Antony. Everybody talks about Antony in some extraordinarily symptomatic way. But this is a particularly powerful one because it comes after his death. And so automatically he's aggrandized. And she is taking pleasure, I would say even kind of erotic pleasure, in having a discussion with someone else who loved him about Antony. His face was as the heavens, and therein stuck a sun and moon, which kept their course and lighted the little O, the earth.
Most sovereign creature.
His legs bestrid the ocean, his reared arm crested the world. His voice was propertied as all the tuned spheres, and that to friends. But when he meant to quail and shake the orb, he was as rattling thunder. For his bounty there was no winter in't, and autumn 'twas that grew the more by reaping. His delights were dolphin-like. They showed his back above the element they lived in. In his livery walked crowns and crownets. Realms and islands were as plates dropped from his pocket.
Cleopatra.
Think you there was or might be such a man as this I dreamt of? You remember the next line? Gentle madam, no. Gentle madam, no. This is your fantasy. So let's look at this fabulous passage. And I'm so glad that Mel did the plates thing, because silver plate is the sort of medial thing. You've heard about, you know, plate in that sense, but the idea that plates were coins is one very good example. What do you observe in this passage? It doesn't have to be what does a word mean, but what do you observe about the language of the passage?
You're going to have to raise your hand and get Larry. I'm sorry. This is quite cumbersome. No, down here. Down here.
There will be two microphones.
In future.
Just somewhat of an arbitrary observation, but it seems very nautical just right off the bat to me.
Nautical?
Yeah.
Show us some nautical
words.
Well,
the descriptive terms, you know, his legs bestrode the ocean, raised above the crested world. Let's see. His delights were dolphin-like. They showed his back above the elements. His realms and islands were his plates dropped from his pockets. Just seems very nautical.
Well,
the
dolphins and the ocean, I will indeed associate with the sea and with its... Shakespeare very often associates the sea with both life-giving forces and with storms that are threatening. His legs bestrid the ocean. What kind of a figure is that? I mean, if his legs bestrid the ocean, what does it say about him? Exactly. So we think about maybe the Colossus of Rhodes. In any case, we think about an enormous figure, because to bestride the ocean is to have 1 foot on land on either side. And what about the dolphins? Larry, we're not quite finished. All right. What about the dolphins? His delights were dolphin-like.
Oh, it kind of juxtaposes from the colossal image brought about with his legs bestrid the ocean. Now you have a very delicate image of a dolphin, you know, porpoising to the ocean.
So you're closer to the ocean here. You
right.
return to the ocean.
More elemental figure rather than a menacing colossal figure.
And the semicolon, and again, Shakespearean punctuation is all imposed by editors. So that you shouldn't, in general, make an argument about a dash or a period or something, because these things will vary from moment to moment. Punctuation in the Elizabethan-Jacobean period was an evolving art, and there were lots of theories about it. But here the semicolon seems to suggest that they showed his back above the element they lived in is an explanation of what dolphin-like meant. It's a kind of physical image. What does element mean here? It's the water. Now, element in this period, you'll see that, I guess we're not reading Twelfth Night, but the element could be air, it could be water, it could be the sky, but it does have to do with how many elements in general were there thought to be? Four elements: air, water, fire, and earth. And this is this old structure of, very much older than Shakespeare, of thinking of the world in these four parts, comes back in play after play after play, that we'll see in The Tempest, that there seems to be a sort of split between the characters that are airy and fire-like and the characters that seem to be earthy and water-like and so forth. So exactly, we have a kind of microcosm of the world here in the showing of the elements in this passage. What else? There was a hand behind you, Larry. No more? No. This gentleman here?
Well, along the same lines and in a more general sense, just the use of the heavens and as all the tuned spheres and as rattling thunder makes him sound godlike or attuned to the heavens and things larger than the earth.
He's hugely magnified. He has become a creature much bigger than the ordinary human. Remember, she's having a conversation with a human being. And she's describing this apotheosis of Antony, where every single thing, his arm crested the world, his voice was property. What does that mean? Propertied. Does it mean?
I don't know. It has the properties of?
Having the properties of, yes, exactly. And it comes from the word proper, meaning your own. So it was propertied. As all the tuned spheres. Now, again, here's the idea of the music of the spheres. This is, again, an old notion about perfection, that the planets travel and they make music as they travel. There's a wonderful poem called Orchestra by a poet called John Davies that writes about this. But because we're fallen, because we're mere mortals, we can't hear that music of the spheres, which is the sign of heavenly perfection. But Antony somehow is that music of the spheres. His voice was propertied as all the tuned spheres, and that to friends. It's the perfect sound. All the way over here.
Sorry. It also seems like a not only perfection, but a kind of a tyrannical perfection. It's you know, she's evoking all these images of nature, but they're not images of human nature. The one thing that struck me was the sun and moon, which kept their course and lighted the little O of the earth. You know, not only is he sort of shedding his light, but he's also controlling.
Why do you say tyrannical, though?
His
dominating, I can see. Tyrannical, say why?
Well, that might just be me being a little hyperbolic.
But a tyrant. Yeah. I mean, even in this period, a tyrant has a not only controlling but a kind of politically negative valence to it. I want to be clear whether you're suggesting that there's something inadvertently or deliberately negative about this figure.
Well, when he meant to quail and shake the orb, he was as rattling thunder.
Uh-huh.
Suggests, you know, that he had one of his methods of, you know, keeping. It seems like she saw him as a.
All right, let's not do it. Seems like. Let's not do it. Seems like. Go back. No, because yeah. We can do it a different way. Go back to the previous line. When his voice was property of all the Tunid spheres, who was he talking to?
To friends.
So this other stuff, the quailing and shaking the orb, who is he talking to?
To anyone he meant to intimidate.
Sure. The non-friends, whether they're enemies, whether they're inferiors, whether they're right, we don't know what they are. But they're not in the others than friends. To quail. What does to quail mean here? Sorry?
To, yes.
Now, it's not that he is quailing, but he's making somebody else quail in this case. This is a kind of transferred epithet. And shake the orb.
Right. And I think the shake the orb with the sun and moon which kept their course and lighted the earth and... you know, for his bounty, there was no winter in it, and autumn 'twas that grew the more by reaping.
Right. Let's just pause on that image for a second. Autumn 'twas that grew the more by reaping. What kind of an image is that? What's happening in that image? Yes.
Just the season of death. There's always, the season of autumn is the season of fruition, or when we harvest.
Say the first thing that you said because it wasn't captured on the tape.
There's no season of death.
There's no season of death, yes. That the autumn, this is very much like Keats's Ode to Autumn, and in fact I think Keats's Ode to Autumn is very much influenced by Antony and Cleopatra. The idea, season of mists and mellow fruitfulness is how that poem begins. The idea that autumn is infinitely fruitful. But the paradox built into this, a bounty 'twas that grew the more by reaping. Now, we might ecologically say that we understand that in fact you have to keep things mown in order to keep them growing and so forth. But there's meant to be a kind of paradox here, that somehow the more you pluck from the tree, the more fruit grows on the tree. The more you take, the more he gives. This is not the first time, and we'll see this, that Shakespeare uses this very image. He uses this same image for Romeo and Juliet as he does for Antony and Cleopatra. That the idea that love is infinite, that bounty precisely comes out of love, and that it cannot be measured by ordinary monetary or numerical or space or time limits. It's about something else. It's about infinity in replication, about infinity in space, about infinity in generosity. So good. So the sun and moon, I think it's crucially important to sort of, and think about this as a kind of cinematic moment in which she starts, what was he like? Well, he was like, you know, something celestial, and you kind of zero in on the sun and moon, and then you kind of come down. Well, this goes back to what you were saying about the ocean then turning into the dolphins, where from way up here where you suddenly see the sun and the moon, you're in the hood blimp or something, you're not going to see those dolphins. It's only when you see the ocean then you can come down closer and closer and closer till you see the dolphins, and you get to the plates in his pocket. So you're all the way now down, focused on him. But what's in his pocket? What's in the pocket of this colossal figure? Is it really plate? It's realms. Realms and islands were as plates dropped from his pocket. So you have simultaneously the figure of a man with coins in his pocket and the figure of a colossal figure with countries and islands spilling out of his pockets because he owns so many of them. He is a figure of the earth. Look back through this passage and see how many times the word as appears. His face was as the heavens. His voice was properties as all the tuned spheres. The realms and islands were as plates dropped from his pocket. So you have both comparison and metaphor here. You're dealing both with the sense that she is always in control of generating these images, and also with the overpowering beauty and intimidation of this huge figure itself. It's a wonderful passage. It's a wonderful passage because it performs what it describes. It starts big and it gets small. And it describes precisely both his majesty and also his accessibility. And at the same time, she is talking to a realist. She's talking to a Roman soldier. And so he keeps trying to interrupt her as if she's having some kind of fugue-like fantasy that he thinks it's dangerous for her to carry on and have. Most sovereign creature, Cleopatra. And finally, when she says to him, think you there was or might be such a man, that's like, as this I dreamt of. Gentle madam, no. Her answer, you lie up to the hearing of the gods. So she just rejects his rationalization. She rejects his idea that no man could be that big or have that much wealth or have realms and islands in his pockets. You lie up to the hearing of the gods. She's going to make her own reality. And that's what we see her do from this part in the play on to the end. How are we doing for time? We're just about, I think, out of time. Let me, rather than start another passage, which I think we don't have time to do. Yes, sir?
What's the reference? What do we infer by the reference to the little hole of the earth?
Yes, thank you so much for because the O, this is a great question. O is a round figure. It is at this point both the letter O and also the number zero. This is precisely the moment in European history when the zero comes from Arabic numbers into use in England, and you'll see in King Lear and all over the place this tremendous fascination with the power of zero, with the cipher, with the idea that a zero with a figure in front of it becomes 10 or 100 or 1,000. But we're also dealing with what in Henry V, he describes as the wooden O, that is the theater, the globe theater, which we think had 16 or 18 sides, which was as close as they could come to making something actually round here. And the wooden O became a phrase to describe the theater space. So the little O, the earth here, is zero, it is O, it is zero, it was all because a circle was also the figure for everything because it was perfect. It was round, it had no beginning and no ending. So we have the perfect circle, everything. We have the zero, which is nothing, and we have the theater, which is the place that mediates between everything and nothing. And we have all of that in the O. And that maybe is as good a place to stop as any. We'll see you next week for Troilus and Cressida. Please bring your plays with you, and please do come with questions, because we are going to ask four questions and depend upon your questions. Thank you.